It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. We're going to wrap up your election recommendations this week.
Yeah, the last couple of weeks we've gone through the ballot measures and the courts and then the elected offices, except the last week we didn't get to the presidency. So, and by the way, those are all online at eatthestate.org. There's a more recent issue than the one in which the endorsement was printed at this point, so you have to go to the back issues and look for the election 08 tragedy or farce article. But it's the previous issue to the one that's up now. Or if you can't find the link, email us at editorial@eatthestate.org, and we will send you the link. But anyway, so we didn't get to the presidency last week, so Maria, who are you voting for?
Actually, I already voted. I filled out my absentee ballot and sent it in. And I'm not alone. There are plenty of people in the states that allow early voting who have been lining up, particularly in those states where there were election controversies in the past and allegations of rigged voting, places like Florida, Ohio.
And places where the voting machines weren't adequately serviced, so there were long, long lines on polling day.
Long, long lines, yeah. And they're finding, particularly in the Deep South, that the people who are coming in for early voting are primarily African American, and I truly believe this, and I can see why they would do it as well. So I'm not alone in voting early. I voted for Obama for president, and I feel in this election more than any in the past that I can't simply vote for a third-party candidate because I see real measurable and dramatic differences between Obama and McCain on some very important issues, particularly the economy. I don't think McCain even understands the problem, much less has any kind of workable solutions, whereas Obama at least understands the problem, and some of the solutions he's putting forward are ones we should do and should have done 10 years ago. When it comes to health care, McCain wants to take away employer-provided health insurance, and he wants to give you a tax credit that would cover maybe one quarter to one half of your costs for buying private health insurance. That just does not work for me. When it comes to executive power, McCain wants to continue the Bush administration's moves towards an executive dictatorship and take away the last checks on executive power that remain. I think that has to be reversed immediately. You know, when it comes to privacy issues, McCain is as bad as Bush. And there's a long list.
It goes on and on.
Yeah, there's a long, long list. And I just feel that in this election, more than any in the past, that it is worth it voting for someone who isn't as good as I'd hoped he would be, but is miles ahead of the Republican candidate.
See, I completely agree with you that Obama is vastly preferable to McCain. And were this a close election in Washington State, I would almost certainly vote for Obama. But it's not. Obama is going to win Washington's electoral votes. And what that means for me as a strategic voter is that this becomes an election where we are free to vote our conscience rather than simply voting for, you know, the one of the two candidates most likely to win. And frankly, there are enough things that trouble me about Obama's policies that I don't feel I can in good conscience vote for him, even though if it were a close race, I would. For example, his pandering to Israel, his continued reliance on the idea of American empire and expansion of the U.S. military, his FISA vote and some of his other votes in the U.S. Senate. He's basically a corporate centrist in the mold of Bill Clinton. And Clinton did some very good things as president. He also did some very bad things. I think progressives who are, you know, starstruck and enamored by Barack Obama are going to be disappointed by him on multiple occasions during his presidency. That being said, I don't know who I'm going to vote for because there aren't any other good choices on the ballot either. There are two seemingly reasonable progressive candidates on the ballot in Ralph Nader and Cynthia McKinney, but I don't find either one of them to be credible. I think Nader's time has come and gone. He's in his fourth run for presidency and is in clear danger of becoming the Harold Stassen of our era. Cynthia McKinney is a little too prone to conspiracy theories and being out in left field or right field or somewhere in the bleachers in some cases, that even though she's I agree with her on many of the issues, I just find her too erratic to be fully comfortable voting for her. The Libertarian candidate Bob Barr, I agree with on some things. I have serious disagreements with him on others. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, we in Eat the State, we endorsed write-in for John Stewart and Tina Fey, and and that was why it's not so much that that we think the election is a joke, but that we don't think any of the choices on the ballot are appealing, combined with the fact that Obama will almost certainly, in fact, will certainly get Washington State's 11 electoral votes.
Yeah, and if you're listening in another state, it might make sense to not necessarily follow what we put in the paper.
If you're in a state where it's likely to be a close election, if I were in a state where it was likely to be a close election, I would almost certainly vote for Obama. Mm-hmm. Just because McCain and Palin, we didn't even talk about what happens if the 72-year-old four-time melanoma survivor John McCain should keel over dead, who the presidency would fall to then, and that's one of the most frightening. That's frightening on its own merits, but it also tells you more than anybody should need to know about John McCain's actual judgment and his willingness to put politics ahead of the good of the country and the world.
Yeah, so there you have it, two different opinions on the elections. Make up your mind on your own and be happy and vote if you can manage the two at the same time.
just don't do it on a full stomach.
Moving on from that to local and some updates on some of the local races.
Yeah, there's been some very interesting developments over the last week in Washington State's political races, but ones that haven't they're major campaign finance violations, and this is the sort of thing that tends to be done at the last moment during campaigns on the idea that we get caught, but the adjudication of it and the penalties don't come until after the election when the damage has already been done, and therefore the political party or the candidate or whomever it is feels it's just part of the cost of doing business is you willfully violate the law, take your penalties later, but hopefully you're in office and you can raise the money from donors to cover the fines and it won't matter. In this case, it's the Republicans who've been out of school, and they've done it on an unprecedented scale for Washington State, starting with the governor's race where we didn't get a chance to talk about this last week, but Dino Rossi has been pretty much caught red-handed coordinating his campaign fundraising with an independent 527 group, in this case the Arch Conservative Building Industry Association of Washington. That's a big, big no-no in campaign finance law, and it's particularly egregious because the BIAW and some of the other Republican-friendly groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Republican, various national Republican groups are pouring unprecedented sums of money into the Washington governor's race, some $7 million into last-minute TV ads. You've seen all the Dino Rossi ads on TV. Well, that money, those ads are all being bought by essentially illegal campaign contributions. Not only that, but you've got both Dave Reichert at the federal level with the FEC in his congressional race against Darcy Berner, and then also Dino Rossi, Rob McKenna, and Doug Sutherland, all Republicans running for statewide office, have been getting essentially illegal loans from local media outlets. And the deal is this. There's a particular company that handles the media buys for Republican candidates in Washington State, and particularly the Seattle ADI, which covers Western Washington and is along with Portland and Spokane, is essentially the major TV markets in Washington State. Usually when television ads are bought by political campaigns, the standard is that you have to pay 7 days in advance. And the reason for that, as opposed to a regular billing cycle for a normal advertising client, is that campaigns are ephemeral things. They won't exist this time next month. Not only that, but they're extraordinarily bad credit risks. They don't have established credit histories, number one. And number two, if your campaign loses and you don't have the cash on hand, what are the chances that you're going to going to be able to raise the money to pay your debts. Not very good. So
plus, I think there's the issue, the ethical issue of appearing not to be giving a donation to a candidate
I'm getting to that. It's not just an ethical issue; it's a legal issue. It's illegal under both federal and state law for media companies to give an ad buying company or a campaign, which they have done in this case, essentially 30 days to pay up front without seeing any of the money up front. It constitutes an illegal loan to a campaign. And the reason is this. What if the campaign decides not to come back? At what point does that become an illegal corporate contribution to a campaign? You can't tell. And so what has happened is Como and Cairo and King TV and Q13 have all given illegal loans to the Republican statewide campaigns and to the Dave Ryker campaign, but have refused a similar deal to the Democratic candidates.
The
reason you haven't heard about this, of course, is that for some reason the media outlets that are responsible for giving you the news on the campaigns, well, first of all, local television news doesn't even cover local politics to begin with. But even if it did, they're not particularly inclined to cover their own illegal behavior. So this is why we have to bring you this news on this program instead.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Moving on. The NBA is going to come to Seattle, whether you like it or not.
Oh, yeah. No, the city, along with the owners group that was looking at trying to buy the Sonics from Clay Bennett, those folks have gotten together and have cooked up the idea of diverting portions of the hotel motel tax to renovating Key Arena they've gotten the okay from NBA Commissioner David Stern that if they could upgrade Key Arena, we might get an NBA team here.
And the NBA has been so reliable in its word to the city in the past that you would spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars based on their say so.
Yeah, and the city just...
Don't even bother getting into writing. Just go ahead and do it.
Right, just do it. And the city has said The city says that there appears to be no competition for the hotel motel tax revenue that would go to Key Arena. And I just want to say, what? What are you thinking? We've got three measures on the ballot this fall, two of which are for city initiatives, you know, one for parks and the other one for Pike Place Market. They could certainly use those funds. Of course, there's competition for the money.
And not only that, but you're looking, because of the stalling economy and revenue shortfalls, you're looking at severe cuts in social spending and really across the board on budgets for the city, for the county, at every level of government for 2009. To say that there's no competition for that is absolutely ludicrous. And to say that the preferred that there is competition, but the preferred way to spend it is with an organization that has just reamed you badly.
Yes.
And that the electorate has already said by a 70-some percent margin that they don't want you doing business with them unless you turn a profit.
Yeah, and on top of that, in order to get an NBA team, we would have to do what Clay Bennett did to us. We would have to go to another city because there are no teams with their leases coming up in the near future. We'd have to go to another city and say, we want your team, and take it away from them.
It's a bad idea.
It's bad.
Really bad.
All right. Moving on. Update on Aaron Wotata.
Yes. Some good news this week. A federal judge, which the Wotata defense took the very unusual step of taking a case that was in the military, quote-unquote, justice system and moving it out to the federal court system. And a federal judge this week essentially stopped the Army from retrying for a second time Aaron Wotata on charges of failure to deploy to Iraq. Now, this doesn't entirely get Wotata out of trouble because they left standing a couple of the lesser charges of conduct unbecoming an officer. That is because of some of Watada's public statements around things like, you know, President Bush being unfit to command the troops and, you know, various other uncomplimentary things
various
that he said.
Various other truthful but uncomplimentary.
Yes, exactly. So this leaves Wotata in kind of a legal limbo until the Army decides whether to proceed on those lesser charges or not. He's been confined to having a desk job at Fort Lewis has for the last year or so while this plays out in the courts. But the good news is that he won't be tried a second time or court-martialed a second time on the charges of failure to deploy for an illegal war. And as you may recall, the reason there was a mistrial the first time around is they were basically winning the case. They were making a compelling case that, in fact, it was an illegal order because the because it's an illegal war and therefore an illegal order. And this was a precedent that the Army desperately did not want to see established. So that's good news.
All right. Well, then that takes us on to this week's economic news.
Yes, I noticed this week that we had another bad week for the Dow, which of course I talked about last week as being something we can foresee for the future. But even this week, even the Wall Street Journal finally joined the media hyperbole with headlines like, quote, "Markets fall as fears of slump span world." And
fears of slump?
Yes, fears of slump span.
You mean
the
it's
world.
Not already happening?
Right.
And the market's lost 40% of its value, and we're talking about the possibility that it might happen.
Right, right. And the subtitles include things like currencies in turmoil and my favorite, which is the globe churns, which, maybe the globe churns, but it makes my stomach turn when they use headlines like that. And of course, next to headlines like that, they always show a distorted graph that shows only the top one third to one half of the market to make the drop appear to be larger than it really is. When in fact, really, if you look at the level of the stock market right now, it's at where it was when the tech stock bubble collapsed. We knew that was a bubble. And we knew too that the market, when it collapsed and lost all that hot air, it was about where it probably should be, around the 8,000 mark, 8,000 to 9,000 mark, the Dow. And now it's about in the same territory after the housing market bubble has collapsed and the credit bubble has collapsed. So there's a good argument to be made that the stock market's really about where it should be. Maybe a little bit under, but not too far from where it should be, and that all of this hysteria is just that, it's hysteria. And right now, investors are going to have to accept the fact that wild gains are not the norm for the market. Slow and very small gains is probably the norm.
What about the indicators that the housing bubble actually hasn't entirely burst, that we still have a ways to go before we reach the floor?
Yeah, well, that's not going to be – I mean, the stock market doesn't exactly track the housing
sure.
market. But let me just run through some numbers because they relate to what you just said. So these numbers that matter more to people's lives than the actual level of the stock market include reports this week that U.S. foreclosures were up 71% in the third quarter of this year. That means an additional 766,000 homeowners received foreclosure-related notices from July to September of this year, and a quarter of a million of them, 250,000, had their homes seized and repossessed by banks. More than a million bank-seized houses are now on the market. That makes up one-third of all properties for sale in the United States, where are bank-seized properties that banks are trying to find buyers for. 12 million U.S. homeowners are underwater on their home mortgages. That means they owe more on their home mortgages than what their homes are actually worth. That means that 23%, or almost one quarter of U.S. homeowners, are just one step away from foreclosure. All they need is one big expense, like a health care crisis or to lose their job, to pitch them over into foreclosure. That's unprecedented. And this week we saw a report from the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that said that of the 30 nations that make up the OECD, the U.S. had the third highest income disparity behind Turkey and Mexico, and that most of the increase in income disparity in the United States came in just the last 10 years. And this week also, the UN released a report that major U.S. cities, that includes New York, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, New Orleans, etc., have levels of income inequality that are equal to cities in Africa. We don't have the same levels of poverty that you see in cities in Africa, but the income disparity is very close to what you see in African cities, meaning that we have a lot of very, very we have a very few extremely rich people in the United States, and we have many, many people who are losing ground in their income levels. So what is the Bush administration doing? Well, it's still pouring money.
Celebrating.
Yeah, it's still pouring.
That's what their policies have been designed for.
Right, right. It's still pouring money into banks. So about half of that $250 billion for bank recapitalization has been spent. What's the money being used for? It's not being used to make loans. The banks are using it to make acquisitions, that is to buy other distressed banks. At least three banks that have received money from the U.S. Treasury have used it to buy, have said that they're going to use it to buy other banks. And PNC Financial Services, just this week, they received a loan from the Treasury. They announced a deal to buy National Citicorp for $2.23 per share. That will double the size of PNC Financial Services, and they will become the U.S.'s fifth largest bank by deposits. So that's what your taxpayer money is doing. It's not being spent to free up the credit markets. It's being spent for these banks to consolidate and become bigger. So what is the Fed doing? I mean, this is what happens when the U.S. Treasury decides to spend this money without taking a controlling ownership in these banks. And sure, they're getting stock in these banks when they give out these loans, but they're not getting voting stock. They're not taking a controlling interest. So these banks are free to use your money in whatever way they want.
And this is what happens when Congress, which should have as one of its first steps in this crisis, reinstituted some of the regulations that have been gutted on the banking industry.
That's right.
Instead, they're still deregulated, and
right,
you
right.
still see some of the short-term predatory practices that got us into trouble in the first place.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's still going on.
Yeah, that's my next point. The Fed and Congress could be imposing some regulations. Well, Congress is on vacation, and what is the Fed doing? The Fed is talking about a rate cut, which would drop interest rates even lower. They're near historic lows at 1.5% right now. And there's an argument that these low interest rates are encouraging the banks that are the mortgage brokers that are making loans right now to continue with their same terrible practices. And in fact, research firm LPS Applied Analytics said this week that 2008 mortgages are trending worse than 2006 mortgages in terms of their creditworthiness. So they're continuing, banks are continuing to make these adjustable rate mortgages, these option only mortgages to people who are bad credit risks. In the absence of regulation, it's profitable for them. And in the absence of regulation, there is nothing to tell them not to do it, even when their own banks are even when their own stock prices are suffering, even when they're being forced to take loans from the federal government. Without the federal government or anybody coming down on them, the bad practices are going to continue. So what is Congress doing? Of course, Congress is on vacation. And instead of talking about, you know, I mean, the Democrats are talking about maybe coming back from vacation and passing some regulation with no support from the Republicans, of course. But they're mostly talking about, because it's an election year, about passing an economic stimulus bill. The Democrats have some good ideas. They want to put money into infrastructure projects. They want to fund food stamps, which desperately need it. And they want to extend unemployment benefits for people who are being kicked out of their jobs, which would help those people make their mortgage payments, certainly. They want a moratorium on foreclosures that might help stabilize the housing market. And they have some other good ideas to help stabilize the housing market. However, the Republicans are not on the same page. They're in fantasy land. They want to pass a package that includes lots more tax breaks and some very stupid ones, including the elimination of a capital gains tax on stocks. It's like, hello, how's that going to stabilize the housing market? No,
especially when nobody's getting capital gains on stocks.
Right, but as Job pointed out to me before we started this morning, that oh yeah, eliminating the capital gains would allow people like John McCain to buy more houses. But the Republicans also want to allow housing speculators, real estate investors, to get the same capital gains exclusions as people who sell their primary residences. Again, it's like, hello, are you living in the same world? That's only going to make the problem worse by driving up housing prices during a bubble. And when housing prices are deflating right now, nobody's making capital gains on their investments anyway, whether you're selling your primary residence or an investment house. So how is that going to help? It's not going to help at all. And they want to lower income tax rates for companies that buy distressed assets. And this is just going to make the credit freeze worse because it's going to encourage banks to hold on to their cash even harder so that they can use it to buy up distressed banks instead of lending that money out. So the Republicans have these ideas that are going to just make things worse, and the Democrats have some good ideas, and they can't get on the same page except for when it comes to maybe agreeing. Both sides agree that, gosh, wouldn't it be a good idea to go to mail out more tax rebate checks, as if that actually helped the first time. So it appears that even as the crisis is deepening, that the federal government in all its aspects, the Fed, the Treasury, and Congress, are completely and utterly incapable of doing anything to help.
In stark contrast to some of the governments in other parts of the world.
Yes.
We might add.
All right. That then takes us to international and Iraq.
Yeah. Don't have a whole lot of time, but did want to note that Iraq announced this week that it is not going to be signing security agreement with the United States under the Bush administration. This is something that the Bush administration has been pushing very hard to try and get done this fall before they leave office, to try and essentially lock in the occupation, to make it very difficult for an Obama administration, for example, to pull out of Iraq in any kind of timely fashion. It looks like that's not going to happen. Of course, the reason it's not going to happen is that there is overwhelming political as well as popular opposition to the occupation within Iraq itself. The piece of this that wasn't supposed to play out was that the supposedly sovereign Iraqi government was supposed to do the United States bidding, exactly as the Bush administration told itself to, but in the face of what nominal democracy there is in Iraq, not to mention the threat of armed insurrection, the Maliki government is backing down and respecting the wishes of its own electorate, which is a good sign.
Yeah, and there are upcoming elections in Iraq, so their politicians are as sensitive to not making a deal with the devil as ours are. So that's one big reason why the Iraqi parliament would never pass this deal, and why Maliki has backed off on signing it.
All right. That moves us on then to this week's events.
Yeah, there are several. Today from 4 to 6 o'clock, George Fearing is running for Congress in central and eastern Washington in the Yakima Valley against the execrable Doc Hastings. Hastings, you may recall, is the Republican who was the chair of the Senate, or the House, rather, Ethics Committee, who did absolutely nothing against Tom DeLay and Duke Cunningham and Tom Foley and all those, or rather Mark Foley and all those really corrupt Republicans over the much of this decade. He usually has a very safe seat, but he's getting a very spirited run from a Democrat named George Fearing this year. And Fearing will be in Seattle today for a fundraiser at the Carpenters Hall in Belltown at Vine and Second between 4 and 6 o'clock. Also today, or rather tonight at 6:30, there will be a benefit auction for Western Washington Fellowship of Reconciliation. That will be at Woodland Park Presbyterian Church at 70th in Greenwood and Finney Ridge. Tomorrow and Monday, and by the way, I owe an apology to the Ralph Nader campaign because they had an event last week and I spaced on announcing it, which is totally my fault. But Cynthia McKinney is in town this week, and by goodness, I'm not going to forget twice. So she is going to be in Seattle tomorrow from 3 to 7 at Umaja Fest Peace Center at 24th and East Spring, and then again on Monday from 11 to 12:30 at the Broadway Performance Hall at the Seattle Central Community College campus at Broadway and Pine and the Capitol Hill. And then also on Monday, the City Council is going to be having its budget hearing Monday evening starting at 5:30. That includes the money for possibly renovating Key Arena. It includes the social service cuts that we talked about coming up for 2009. And it includes, in the face of those social service cuts, $220 million for a new jail, the jail, ironically, that's supposed to be sited where Nicholsville was originally camped a couple of weeks ago. That money could be saved by diversion programs and whatnot to decrease the prisoner population and spend it instead on the social programs that might prevent some of those people from getting ensnared in the justice system in the first place. But instead, Greg Nichols and the city council seem to want to build a new jail, and there will be, I know the Real Change folks are going to be down there and some other folks agitating against that. So that's five, and the budget in general is something where this will be the one opportunity for the public to be heard. So that's 5:30 on Monday, this coming Monday at City Hall.
All right, talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a volunteer publication. You can find it where you get free publications around town, cafes, bookstores, on the web, libraries, etc. It's also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. Again, that's where you'll find your election recommendations. In the previous issue, you go to back issues, and then hit, I believe it's volume 13, number 3. And again, if you can't find that link, email us at editorial@eatthestate.org, and we'll send it to you.